It's the government associated with the White Roots of Peace. Paul Wallace's book gives an account of the founding of the Longhouse. I find it interesting. Wallace quotes the I Am Daganoweda, the founder of this international league. This involves the bearing of the hatchets under the great white pine of peace. I see this as part of the history of globalization. This was an effort to conceive of a universal legal code, a way for human beings to regulate their antagonisms and bury the hatchet and settle their differences through negotiation, through discussion, through conflict resolution rather than violence. And this author here has, if I can go back here, connected it to the League of Nations. We, the peoples of the United Nations, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war. So this is... there's different images I could refer to here. But here is DISCA has installed in the Six Nations Council 1917. He was in 1921 appointed speaker at Ottawa, London, and Geneva, Switzerland. He defended the rights of the Six Nations, oldest League of Nations now in existence. So the people in this tradition see themselves as the first League of Nations, the oldest league. And the teaching was that it wasn't just for those five nations, it was for all peoples of the world to come under the protection of the Great White Pine of Peace. So the British Empire aligned themselves with this group, used this group as a way to infuse their influence into Canada. So I'm using this as a introduction to other forms of adaption to imperialism, Aboriginal adaptation to imperialism, or outright resistance. Here's the trial of Louis Riel, who was tried for treason, for opposing the way the Canadian government asserted its jurisdiction in the Saskatchewan Valley in 1885. Of course, Louis Riel was hung. The government of John A. Macdonald lost an enormous amount of political capital in Quebec, and the Conservative Party was essentially decimated in Quebec ever since. Although the Conservative Party had originally negotiated a kind of accord between the Orangemen of Upper Canada and the Roman Catholics in Lower Canada. Until Riel created the provisional government at the time of the transfer of the Hudson's Bay Company lands to the Dominion of Canada. In that power vacuum, he created and was secretary of a provisional government. And during that period, they executed Thomas Scott. Thomas Scott, of course, was a Orangeman. Orangemen were proud Protestant activists, taking their reference to Ireland, which is a place of profound antagonism between Roman Catholics and Protestants. So the murder of Thomas Scott, an Orangeman, by Roman Catholic Métis was the seed of the demise of Riel. But in the course of Canada's attempting to assert jurisdiction in what's now Western Canada in the former Hudson's Bay Company lands, they picked up Big Bear in 1885, incarcerated Big Bear, who was actually a pacifist and was trying to hold his people back from violent response to Canada. This is in 1885, and Poundmaker. So I'm trying to establish a pattern here where I can connect, say, Pierre Dominique Toussaint Louverture, and I can connect Tecumseh, and I can connect Big Bear and Poundmaker and Louis Riel to Lumumba, for instance, that here are indigenous peoples trying to deal with the expansion of empire onto their territory. And they're trying to oppose that expansion, or at least infuse that expansion with some kind of recognition of their position within these imperial systems. And so I'm trying at the end of this course to make these connections, that we've looked at the history of imperialism as a force of globalization, and little by little we've been getting an image of those who opposed imperialism or those who attempted to adapt to it in different ways and infuse imperialism with some kind of recognition of Aboriginal rights and Aboriginal titles. You know, we've talked, for instance, about the Zapatistas and their opposition to the North American Free Trade Agreement, which came into force in 1994. We've talked about how they used the internet so successfully. We've talked about Edward Said, and we should talk more about Edward Said. But Edward Said identified, for instance, the social scientists who traveled with Napoleon to Egypt in 1799, and how social scientists' representation of indigenous peoples built up this image of civilized people and lesser people, and in a way gave justification to the imposition of foreign systems on indigenous peoples. I know, Lissa, you've been looking for this text here, but here it is, Titus Alexander's Unraveling Global Apartheid. And Titus Alexander gives an overview of world politics based on the view that South Africa, as it was prior to the extension of the universal franchise, and in a way, the extension of the universal franchise still leaves unaddressed many of the economic inequities of that country. But the concentration of so much of the resource wealth of South Africa in the hands of the white minority community and the marginalization of the indigenous majority economically to this day and politically until quite recently, he looks at this as a kind of metaphor for the global system, the way the global system concentrates so much wealth in a sense, the beneficiaries of imperialism. And if you think of, you know, who were the imperialism and who are the children of the imperialists, and has the apportionment of global wealth changed since the heyday of imperialism? And you could say, well, no, it really hasn't changed very much. Those who were marginalized and the poorest in the old imperial system, it tends to be the same communities which are in the same position, and the same communities that were in the beneficiaries of imperialism the structure is still there. Of course, Kwame Nkrumah looks at this phenomena, which he calls neocolonialism, and says that colonialism never really ended, but now it continues through economic institutions. it's interesting when you think of the boarding school, the legacy of the boarding schools, which went up to the 1960s, early 1970s in Canada. These schools were created essentially to advance a civilizing mission, to encourage Indigenous peoples to join the mainstream culture, to learn the English and French languages, put aside their own languages, break the connection with their elders, with their grandparents, so that they would be more readily assimilated. Those institutions have been transcended, but when you think of the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund, when you think of the conception of failed states, there still is this idea that, you know, you need to learn how to use your finances. You need to structure your finances in such a way that you'll be responsible, and only then can you really acquire the full powers of self-government. So until you do, you're kind of under wardship or trusteeship. I'm suggesting that this concept of global apartheid, that there are some continuities where the old language had to do with religion and race, the new language has to do with economics, but the patterns, the economic language disguises in a sense the perpetuation of the old systems. So let's return to Meredith's text. So I enjoyed this volume for a number of reasons. I find myself these days looking at pictures because obviously if you can explain concepts and you can attach pictures to them, I think it brings things to life. Here is Jomo Kenyatta. And the Moscow-trained revolutionary Jomo Kenyatta pictured attending the Pan-African Congress in Manchester in 1945. After 12 years abroad, he was impatient to return to Kenya to engage in the nationalist struggle. "I feel like a general separated by 5,000 miles from his troops," he told his English wife, Edna. So here he is with, as Prime Minister in 1963, Kenyatta offered amnesty to Mau Mau rebels still at large, like Field Marshal Muyama. But he remained highly critical of the Mau Mau rebellion. Those who built up an organization of unbridled violence in Kenya were never the political associates or executive colleagues of Kenyatta. So Mau Mau was one of the movements in Africa that sent shivers of fear among those who the Mau Mau opposed. Kenya is a mountainous country. Parts of it are mountainous, and in the highlands of Kenya, the climate reminded me very much of Canada. I mean, there's pine trees. It's a climate that Europeans find agreeable. It's because it's high, it's cold, and so the displacement of many of the Kikuyu from the highlands of Kenya, they responded with a movement, an armed movement based on asserting their rights to land and title through force. So the Mau Mau were quite a force to be reckoned with. Kenyatta, in a sense, was representing them, although he kept his arms distance from them. Kenyatta was very much in the capitalist camp, and Nairobi, when I was there in 1971, was a very modern city. Parts of it were very modern. There was still big areas of the city where white people dominated and had their many servants and, you know, spent long time in the club, in the golf club, or sipping gin and tonic or whatnot. That was one approach. I was interested to read in this text about the poet President Leopold Senghor, pictured with his wife at a celebration marking Senegal's first year of independence from France. As a Catholic in a predominantly Muslim country, Senghor became adept at building coalitions without appealing to religious or ethnic affiliation. His inclination for compromise and persuasion became an integral part of Senegal's political tradition. So Senghor went to Paris. He was part of the literary community, the famous literary community of Paris. And he represented and embodied that view where his goal as a young man was essentially to assimilate himself into the Parisian culture, into the French culture. He was at first quite openly contemptuous of his own indigenous roots. There is in the French imperial history a view that we can accept any kind of people into our nationality, into our identity, as long as they learn our culture and assimilate our institutions and show loyalty to our institutions. The British system didn't seem to have that same approach. There were kind of different categories that you were placed in different categories. So little by little, there came to be questioning of that approach among the elite French individuals, black individuals from Africa who assimilated themselves into French culture. At one stage, they wrote about and started to conceptualize something called negritude, like Negro, negritude. And this set off part of a process of little by little moving towards independence, leaving the position that they would accept to be citizens of France, to have political representation in the French Parliament. Emperor Haile Selassie was considered to be a god by the Rastafarians. Rasta, man, you know, the dreadlocks, Marcus Garvey had a lot to do with it. Actually, the librarian at Laurentian University, where I used to work, had been the librarian for Haile Selassie. And he talked about, you know, when these Jamaicans came looking for Haile Selassie and wanting to see Haile Selassie and meet him, how, you know, sort of awkward it was. He maintained this regime in Ethiopia based on Ethiopia, of course, has a form of Christianity, a very ancient form of Christianity, Coptic Christianity, which is quite distinct from the Roman Catholic tradition, from the Byzantine tradition. And it gives a fascinating account of that regime, which was later overthrown in favor of a communist regime. Here is the great, the one and only Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, with Sesi Seko, with Mobutu, in 1974, when they're preparing, when Cassius Clay is preparing for the what do they call it, the rumble in the jungle with George Foreman. If you've seen the film Muhammad Ali, what's it called? It's Ali. It dramatizes that. As we As we develop this picture, we can see that the struggle for liberation of blacks in Africa engages the attention and concern of blacks in North America. And that's a very fascinating story. Let me take this opportunity to introduce W.E.B. Du Bois. So I'm seeing W.E.B. Du Bois in the line of those who grappled with imperialism and attempted to oppose imperialism. I'm seeing W.E.B. Du Bois as a figure in line with Toussaint Louverture, with Tecumseh, with Louis Riel. Here is the last known photograph of W.E.B. Du Bois. And the last known photo was taken at the his home in Accra. So W.E.B. Du Bois spent his final years with Kwame Nkrumah in Ghana. He became kind of like the advisor or mentor of Kwame Nkrumah. And W.E.B. Du Bois is a founder of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, which is played a major role in terms of the lawyering of the civil rights issues in the United States, has been a very high-profile organization of blacks in the United States who have fought for their rights. And in opposing the majority U.S. system, the majority community, culture, the white majority in the United States, there's a lot of connections between the decolonization movement in Africa and this particular line of the decolonization struggle. The burning of William Brown in Omaha, Nebraska, September 1919. So this is the charred remnants of a figure who was burned alive. And of course, thousands of blacks in the United States have been lynched, simply murdered in cold blood in public rituals. 1919, of course, was the year of the Red Scare. It was the year of the general strike in Seattle. It was a time when it seemed that the social order was destabilized. Certainly the revolution and the emergence in Russia of the Bolsheviks as a force to be reckoned with, and ultimately the creators of a new regime. Lenin, before he came to power, of course, I meant to bring that text in, he wrote a book called Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism. So the founding of the Soviet Union, the rhetoric of the founding of the Soviet Union was that it was in line with an anti-imperial struggle. And certainly Woodrow Wilson was dealing with Soviet propaganda when he came up with the 14 points, when he said that, you know, the United States is entering the First World War not to take sides in an imperial contest, not to take the side of one empire over another, but to liberate people from all empires. And so he spoke of the self-determination of peoples. He spoke of a vision of a universal parliament where human beings would negotiate their differences in a democratic fashion. And Biscaha, when he went from, you know, he saw himself as a founder of the original League of Nations, the Five Nations Iroquois, and he went to Geneva with the view of calling attention to the reality that all these principles he believed applied to his own people. I just got back from Brantford over the weekend. There's a blockade set up on the building of a subdivision just outside this reserve where this famous government, well, there's a lot of controversy over who can claim the powers of this government and the identity of this government, and I'm quite anxious to see what transpired. I was briefly in the Cayuga courthouse in the Grand River Valley, and anyway, this particular group is kind of taken a particular interest in them. Here is a picture of Marcus Garvey. Marcus Garvey is from Jamaica. Marcus Garvey was at the center of a very active liberation movement among Native Americans, primarily in the United States, but also in the Caribbean. He was promoting this Back to Africa movement. He purchased ships and wanted to establish a black, they called it the Black Star Lines. He saw these ships as playing a role in moving blacks back to Africa. W.E.B. Du Bois and Garvey were antagonists, W.E.B. Du Bois saw Garvey as wrong-headed in many ways. Garvey was a populist. Du Bois was a Harvard-educated social scientist. And when I read about Du Bois' 60 years of activism, he was editor of the Journal of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. He, you know, struggled in decades when, at the height of the Jim Crow segregation system in the South, when the United States was, you know, a highly segregated community, when blacks basically couldn't vote. So I'll just go through some of these pictures. W.E.B. Du Bois with his various associates. There he is. He wrote history books on Reconstruction. He's a major literary figure. Here he is with Paul Robeson. Paul Robeson is the great opera singer. And isn't it Paul Robeson that sings, "Old Man River, it keeps on flowing, that old man river, it keeps," you know, he's a beautiful singer. By this time, Robeson and W.E.B. Du Bois. Thank you very much. Well, we are, we're 50 yards from the Old Man River here, so, it's kind of a license there. Anyway, by this time, it's interesting to read this account. In World War I, Du Bois is actively promoting blacks to sign up in the army, and he writes about the role of blacks in the army. He organizes a conference, a Pan-African conference, and his idea is that a group of trustees of highly educated blacks should take over responsibility for the German colonies in Africa and promote some kind of pan-African effort to elevate Africans to a higher educational standard. Little by little, he becomes increasingly alienated and disappointed with American society. Little by little, he becomes a Marxist. He accepts communism, and he goes on this journey with Paul Robeson. So you can imagine in the 1950s, in the McCarthy era, they were harshly dealt with. So here is W.E.B. Du Bois with Mao Zedong. W.E.B. Du Bois with Mao Zedong at Mao's villa in South Central China, April 1959. And here he is with Nikita Khrushchev. There's quite an account of a New Year's celebration at the Kremlin. And he ends up in Ghana with Kwame Nkrumah. So to go back to the account of what happened in Congo, what happened after Patrice Lumumba was removed. In Washington terminology, Mobutu was a friendly tyrant, a reliable ally during the Cold War years, worth propping up with infusions of aid, even though he duly appropriated for his personal use. He made regular visits to Washington, befriending a succession of U.S. presidents. In Meredith's book, he's referred to as, and recall that we've devoted a lot of this class to quoting and using the pictures from this wonderful text, The Fate of Africa, From the Hopes of Freedom to the Heart of Despair, A History of 50 Years of Independence by Martin Meredith. And so in chapter 17, he goes on to give an account of Mobutu's handling of the government of Congo. And recall that I suggested that Mobutu could be conceived as the heir of Leopold II, that Leopold II sort of set the pattern of a tyrannical dictator governing the country, and Mobutu seems to return to some of those themes. Mobutu was regarded as a particularly valuable asset by the United States. Since the Congo's chaotic debut at independence in 1960, Washington had been determined, above all, to ensure that the country remained a pro-Western bulwark against communist ambitions in Africa. After his coup in 1965, Mobutu remained on the CIA's payroll for some time and received regular briefings from Larry Devlin, the CIA station chief in Leopoldville. So Mobutu creates something which he calls authenticité. He changes the name of Congo to Zaire. He changes his own name from Mobutu to Joseph Mobutu to Sese Seko. Sese Seko means valiant warrior in one of the African languages. So it casts a strange light on some of this use of indigenous terminology. If we can go back to the board here. In the 1980s, his fortune was estimated to total $5 billion. And essentially, it became a kleptocracy. Conrad Black's company was called a kleptocracy. A kleptocracy is a polity based on theft. And this tends to be a pattern in the American empire, that you have these strong men, usually army generals, who essentially acquire as their own personal property a huge portion of the national wealth of these polities. Marcos in the Philippines was famous for that. Duvalier in Haiti. Suharto in Indonesia. It's as if doing business in these polities, you have to cut in the ruling dictator, and the ruling dictator claims a major chunk of the financial action. Let's just finish this up in the last few minutes here. Mobutu sustained direct links to the White House through successive administrations. He regarded George Bush Sr. as a personal friend, meeting him first when he was CIA director. When Bush visited Kinshasa as U.S. vice president in November 1982, shortly after Mobutu had imprisoned Tshisekedi's dissidents, he was generous in his praise. "I've come to appreciate the dynamism that is so characteristic of Zaire and Zairians," and to respect your dedication to fairness and reason, said Bush. I've come to admire, Mr. President, your personal courage and leadership in Africa. Mobutu also struck up a warm friendship with President Reagan, regularly visiting him in Washington. When George Bush became president in 1989, on the plane to Washington for a reunion, the first African head of state to pay an official visit. As regards George Bush, he said, I've met him 13 times. We know each other from way back. He was in charge of the CIA, and he knew Zaire's problems backwards. He received me at his home in Maine with his mother, wife, children, and grandchildren. I met him again recently at the funeral of Emperor Hirohito. He's an intelligent, open, and sensitive man with strong convictions. As they stood together on the south lawn of the White House, Bush was equally fulsome. Zaire is among America's oldest friend, and its president, President Mobutu, one of our most valued friends, he said, and we are proud and very, very pleased to have you with us today. When he refers to Zaire as among America's oldest friends, I'm sure he has in mind the founding of the Free Congo State, delegation of powers to Leopold II as a kind of proxy of U.S. rule. Of course, the United States always, in that time, took a great pride in the fact it's not an imperial power. The United States was created in opposition to the imperialism of Great Britain, and so it was seen to be unseemly to actually create a U.S. colony in the heart of Africa. The United States, however, moved out of that position when it joined in the war, when it took up the tools of war to fight the Spanish in Cuba, in Philippines, in Puerto Rico. And obviously the United States moved out of its anti-imperialism when it took up the instruments of war in Vietnam and took over from the French in Vietnam. And obviously the tension and struggle over the U.S. role in Vietnam, we're increasingly seeing duplicated in a growing internal rift within the United States about the role the U.S. should be playing in Iraq. I'm hearing it said that from Iraqis that it's no longer a question of will Iraq go into civil war. Civil war is here. Civil war is now in Iraq. We saw how that history was dealt with in 1960 in Congo, and how that type of milieu resulted in the demise of Patrick Lumumba. So that's tonight's lecture, and we'll see you next week for focus on health, Alberta, and the proposed changes to the healthcare system in Alberta. We'll try to put this in a national context, in a continental focus, maybe even a global focus, and we'll hope to host some kind of discussion, province-wide discussion, and any ideas and help and actually basically promoting it and calling attention to it. If you know somebody who might speak or might be interested, they can come in here and take part here. Hopefully we'll get a place in Edmonton. And we actually have, U of L has a campus in Edmonton, and hopefully we can commandeer the video conference facilities in Edmonton, and we can have an active chat. That's wonderful to bring in, you know, a voice from outside the room and remind ourselves that we actually do have a presence out in the world as we do this class. And we'll see you next week.